Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. I hope you had a beautiful weekend, a special weekend. And of course, we have a lot to talk about. It was a busy weekend and there is much to discuss. We do so with a terrific panel as always. Let me introduce them to you. We also welcome you into the conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will get started. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm here, Joe. And how are you? I'm good.
I'm good. Know, well, thank you.
I got out there. I did the thing. And I said, got to beat the snow. And I did. Now it's really coming down here in Great Barrington.
You beat it.
Where we're told we're only going to get 1 inch. But it looks like it's really snowing.
For another Great Barrington weather report, let's go to Dr. Jim Fagan. Dr. Fagan, how are things looking out of your window this morning?
Yeah, I think I agree with Alan. It is definitely snowing.
Dr. Fagan is a pediatric immunologist. He joins us regularly to discuss what is going on in the world of COVID and with this pandemic, and joins us this morning, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Dr. Fagan, thank you for taking time out. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
We also welcome Malcolm Nance, the counterterrorism expert extraordinaire and best-selling author. His books make fine gifts this holiday season. Good morning, Malcolm Nance. How are you?
Good morning. You know, I don't think about my books like that, but they do make fine gifts. They will terrify you, which is exactly what you want for Christmas.
That's right. So, if you just want to scare the zippers off someone that you love, your book is perfect for that.
You know what's great is that my next book is coming out after Christmas, so you got a whole year to be afraid.
There you go. All right. Well, we look forward to it. We welcome you, sir. Thank you very much for being with us. Jennifer Burns is a UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Jennifer, good morning, and how are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm well.
Excellent. Good to hear. We also check in with our dear friend Libby Post, political consultant to the stars. Good morning.
Yay.
Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. You know?
I'm good.
Everything's fine. Good to be here. Good to be with all of you. Let's get started. We'll start off and talk about what's going on. And since we have the doctor for a short time here, we'll start with those stories having to do with the pandemic. Of course, the dual stories here continue to be. They have been for a long time. Which is, we are seeing some of the worst numbers we have ever seen. We are breaking records, unfortunate, horrible records, day after day after day. Yes, the past week was the deadliest week we have seen since this pandemic struck the United States of America. That, of course, is a story in and of itself. Meanwhile, we are, as of this very second, preparing for a vaccine. I believe right here in New York State, the first vaccine will be given in a short time, and that is the case throughout states in the country. So we have two tracks of discussion this morning when it comes to coronavirus. One, of course, is the continuing just toll that this pandemic is taking. And then, of course, as we get ready, and who has access to the vaccine and who immediately does not. So, Dr. Fagan, let us begin with you. You've been on our program now for several weeks, and last week, you know, told us that we're seeing some of the worst numbers. We now have seen numbers even worse than those. And from all accounts, this seems like it's going to get much worse before it gets any better. I'm wondering if you can sort of give us a sense of where we are right now when it comes of competing with the messages, oh yes, there's a vaccine out there, and making sure people still do what they need to do.
Well, we now are approaching, 17 million total cases in the United States and approaching around 300,000 deaths total in the United States. We're looking at about 3,000 deaths per day. And as we talked about last week, these numbers are all predictable. We knew that following Thanksgiving, there was going to be a surge, and there is. It usually is a week or two after, you know, a major event, and that's exactly what we're seeing. We now have over 100,000 patients hospitalized in the United States, which means that we're, you know, they're occupying about 10% of all of the hospital beds in this country. And so the medical infrastructure is really stressed to the point that, you know, there's real concern what's going to happen in a couple of weeks, because we're looking at Christmas, you know, in a week and a half, and, you know, what's going to happen after that. So things are, you know, are really out of control in the United States with regard to this pandemic. Now, the good news, as you point out, is that, you know, thank goodness we now have a vaccine, and we're going to see today marks the day number one of vaccine administration. And so that, as we talked about last week, you know, is the light, the strong light at the end of a very long tunnel. It's going to take us a while, though, to get to the end of that tunnel, as we talked about. In order for the vaccine to be really effective, we have to establish what we call herd immunity, which means that about 70% of the population of the country will have to be immune to this virus. That's a lot of people to vaccinate, Joe. We're talking about, you know, we have 328 million people in this country. We're talking about 240, 250 million people who would need to be vaccinated. So that's gonna take some time. You know, and I think that, you know, there are issues with regard to the logistics of this vaccine. And we're now, the one that's been approved, that has received emergency use authorization, is the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, which is that messenger RNA vaccine, you know, which we talked about. And I think this is extremely effective, and from all of the data that's been generated, it appears to be very, very safe. And so I'm certainly hopeful that the large percentage of American public will buy into this. I think that at last count, what I saw was around 60-70% of people said that they would take this vaccine, which would be great, because if we can get 70% to take it, then we will reach herd immunity. But that's going to take, you know, some time to vaccinate all of those individuals. So we have a ways to go.
So, Jim, I have a question for you. I know that when you first came on, you described how you would get into the garage next to your house and take your clothes off and throw them into the, because you've been dealing with patients, COVID patients. Are you going to get the shot? I would hope so.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the question, absolutely. I mean, I think that whenever I can, whenever it's offered, I will get it. I think the individuals who need to be vaccinated first and foremost are those medical personnel, those staff who work out of emergency rooms and urgent care centers, who are really, you know, at the front line of this battle against COVID-19. I think those and the entire staff of the emergency facilities really should be vaccinated, and then go down the line in terms of other medical professionals. Absolutely, I would encourage everybody to get vaccinated as soon as it becomes available to them.
And when it comes, you know, we also, I want to enter this into the equation, I tell this story, but not to be, you know, not to try to gain sympathy on any side, but I just find it an interesting in the times of which we live and the times that this administration have created. But it came out yesterday that the White House was going to get first crack at this vaccine, and the internet blew up. And then they said, okay, well, we're not going to, the president tweeted, well, we're not going to take it. We're not going to take it. And then the internet blew up again and said, why don't you trust it? So I'm just more. So, I mean, this is okay, but that's the environment that was created through this whole thing. And it continues. That's a microcosm of what we're dealing with, of trying to say to increase that number that you mentioned of 60% of the people who say that they'll take it to up that to a higher degree.
Well, there are a number of past presidents who said that they would take this vaccine publicly. I know that Joe Biden said that he would take this publicly. And I think it would be a good example if Donald Trump publicly got vaccinated. Even though he had the infection, we are recommending that even those individuals who were infected with COVID-19 get vaccinated against this. And I can explain the reasons for that. But it's indicated that everybody get vaccinated. And I think that, public confidence in the vaccine is critically important. And I think that it would help to see public officials get vaccinated so that to increase the confidence that this is safe and it's an effective vaccine. I think that's going to be really, really, really important in order to get everyone to buy into this.
We have a frustrated. There's just a few letters have come in that I find frustrating because people are saying I have absolutely no intention whatsoever of getting the vaccination, which is, of course, interesting. But they're not taking it the next step and telling us why. I would be interested in why. Of course. What we've been told from people who do say that they're not taking it is because they don't trust it because it was done so fast. We have another letter from a listener who says 9 months seems super fast for a vaccine. If it fails and has adverse effects not seen in clinical trials, what happens then? How do we answer those questions?
Well, I think that, I think public confidence in vaccine safety and efficacy is critical. We've all heard about Operation Warp Speed, which is, a partnership of the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Defense and the private sector, and Operation Warp Speed is pushed to make this vaccine available in record time. And that, I think, has raised some concerns about maybe the standards for safety and efficacy were relaxed a little bit, but I don't think that's the case, Joe. I think the FDA has absolutely reaffirmed that vaccine decisions were based on scientific data and that there were really no compromises with respect to evidence-based standards. The safety issues were subjected to the same time-tested processes for evaluating and regulating vaccines that have been in place at the FDA and the CDC for many years. The emergency use approval was approved by the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, and the center is directed by Dr. Peter Marks, whose intelligence and integrity I have absolute total confidence in, and I know that they made the right decision. And I think that the whole process was, transparent, and I think legitimate in terms of the approval procedure. The fact that that this vaccine developed in record time does not mean that there were compromises in safety or efficacy. It just means that the full attention of many, many pharmaceutical companies and the federal government and the NIH and the CIA, everyone was focused on this. It reminds me of what happened during the early days of HIV. I think that, it's an example of how amazingly capable we are of accelerating certain processes without compromising safety or efficacy. And I think that we should have full confidence in this vaccine. Are there adverse reactions? I mean, and I think that we should sort of talk about those as well. If you looked up the side effect of a baby aspirin, you probably would have second thoughts about taking it. But in terms of vaccine, there are adverse reactions. A vaccine adverse reaction is an untoward effect caused by a vaccine that is extraneous to the vaccine's primary purpose, which is producing immunity. Vaccine adverse reactions, there are three basic types of adverse reactions. There's local, systemic, and allergic reactions. Local reactions are the least severe and the most frequent, and allergic reactions are the most severe and the least frequent. Local reactions occur, they include things like, pain, swelling, and redness at the injection site. And these are very, very common. In fact, I tell people that's actually a good sign because it means that the vaccine is actually working. The immune, it's generating an immune response. Local reactions are most common with inactivated vaccines that contain adjuvants, which are chemicals that help create a stronger immune response. And then there are, systemic adverse reactions are more generalized, include, fever and malaise and muscle aches and pains and headaches and loss of appetite. And they can be caused by the vaccine, or sometimes they're caused by things completely unrelated to the vaccine, like a concurrent viral infection. But we see systemic reactions commonly with live attenuated vaccines. By the way, the COVID-19 vaccine is not a live attenuated vaccine, so it's unlikely that you're going to probably have a systemic reaction to that vaccine.
Doctor, I need to pause you there because we need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, I promise. Panel at WAMC.org, if you'd like to join in, we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, and our special guest for the next few minutes, Dr. Jim Fagan, a pediatric immunologist who is joining us as our expert on coronavirus and COVID-19. Alan.
I have a question for you, Jim, if it's okay.
Yeah.
I desperately want to take that vaccine. I prefer not to die. And so it's really quite simple. I want to take it. However, there is an intervening variable, as we social scientists sometimes say, and that is that once I had an allergic reaction to a bee sting, and now we're told those with allergies might want to hold back. Not me, because, if I have an allergic reaction, we have emergency rooms, we have people who can handle it. So what do I do, lie?
No, you don't lie. And let me talk a little bit about the allergic reaction. Okay. The allergic reaction to the vaccine, that's the third type. There's the local reaction, systemic reaction, and then allergic reaction to the vaccine is the third type of adverse vaccine events. And these reactions, do tend to be severe. Some of them are deemed anaphylactic, which means they can be life-threatening. The allergic reaction may be triggered by the vaccine antigen, which is the immunizing component of the vaccine, or some other vaccine component, such as cell culture material, stabilizer, preservative, or whatever else is in there. And these type of allergic reactions, let me just tell you, are exceedingly rare, occurring at a rate of less than 1 in 500,000 doses. Anaphylactic reactions are the most severe type of allergic reactions. And as I said, they can be life-threatening. Typically, they will occur within minutes to an hour or so after receiving the vaccine. Much more likely to occur very shortly after the vaccine is administered. And, the signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis would be swelling of the lips, the tongue, the throat, difficulty swallowing, difficulty breathing, coughing, wheezing, hives, a drop in blood pressure, things like, and obviously this is very serious, but this is exceedingly, exceedingly rare. In my entire career, I think I've seen one or two kids who had an allergic type of reaction to a vaccine. The local reactions are common. The systemic reactions are common, but the allergic reactions are not common. But let me make a comment about, the allergy. First of all, I was astounded by the fact that in the combined phase 3 clinical trial of Pfizer and Moderna, which included 74,000 people, there was not a single case of an allergic reaction to the vaccine. It was astounding to me that on day one of administration of this vaccine in the UK, two individuals reportedly developed an allergic reaction. Now, I haven't seen the data on that, and was this truly an allergic reaction? I would love to see exactly what happened to these individuals. But let me just make one general comment, and I think this is critically important. Allergy is not generic. Being allergic to peanuts or insect venom or some other food or a medication or penicillin, that has absolutely nothing to do with allergy to a vaccine. Nothing at all. And, I will say this. I disagree with the statement that people who have a history of having had anaphylaxis to a food or to a medication are at risk for a severe reaction to the vaccine. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. There are things in the vaccine, in the COVID-19 vaccine, which are added as sort of vaccine stabilizers, and you know, which may have been responsible for the reaction that those two Brits had to the vaccine. There's something like called polyethylene glycol, which is in that COVID-19 vaccine, and there are rare individuals who may be allergic to that. And if they are, and they get that through the vaccine, they may have a reaction. But again, this is exceedingly rare. I mean, we're talking about probably closer to 1 in 1,000,000 people who will have an allergic type of reaction. So, you know, there is absolutely, you should have absolutely zero concern, in my view, to take that COVID-19 vaccine because you have another type of allergy.
You know, I'm taking it. Well, Jim, I'm going to take it if they'll give it to me. I'm just worried that I go in there, and if I say, you know, I once got stung by a bee and I had an anaphylactic reaction, that they won't give it to me. That's why I asked you whether I should lie, because I would much rather have a reaction than face death.
Yeah. By the way, when you say you had an anaphylactic reaction to insect venom, you had to be rushed to the hospital?
I went to the emergency room.
Did they give you epinephrine?
They did.
Okay. Well, then you must have had a severe reaction.
The symptoms you talked about, you know, there were hives and stuff like that. It wasn't to the point where I was in, you know, where I was dying or anything.
The reason I'm asking you those questions is because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what constitutes a severe allergic reaction. If you just had generalized hives, for example, that would not be an anaphylactic reaction. That would not be an indication to receive epinephrine. So, you know, the diagnosis of anaphylaxis really includes things like significant respiratory difficulty, you know, drop in blood pressure, swelling of the throat. So those are the things that we would really worry about.
I didn't have those. Yeah.
Yeah. So you probably did not have an anaphylactic reaction to infection.
I probably used the word wrong.
But that's why my advice to you would be don't use the word anaphylaxis. Yeah, so you have an insect venom allergy. That's got nothing to do with anything in terms of raising the likelihood that you would have an adverse reaction to the vaccine. And again, I think this is really important. I took issue with the general statement that anyone with a history of severe allergy should not receive this vaccine. I think that's incorrect. Again, allergy is not generic. You know, you're being allergic and severely allergic to things like insect venom or certain foods or medications has no bearing on your likelihood to have a severe allergic reaction to this vaccine. You would have to be allergic to a component of the vaccine. There is no antibiotic in this vaccine. You know, there certainly is no insect venom in this vaccine. So there would be absolutely no reason why you would expect to have an adverse reaction. And I think that that's important. I would hope that individuals who had a history of anaphylaxis, I would hope that they would not be excluded from this vaccine. In my view, that would be a big mistake.
All right. We have a lot of letters from listeners. Let's get to as many as we possibly can here in the few minutes that we have with Dr. Fagan. From Jim to another Jim. If one spouse takes vaccine and the other doesn't, is either one put at risk?
Well, certainly if one spouse is vaccinated, the other spouse would not be at risk for anything. In fact, the risk would be somewhat attenuated because you would not expect the spouse who was vaccinated to come down with COVID-19. You know, one of the issues is, you know, can you still transmit, if you're vaccinated, can you still transmit, you know, an infection? And the honest answer is we don't know yet. I mean, it's a novel vaccine, but I've said this before on the show, in my personal view, I think that's going to be very, very unlikely. The question is, does the vaccine prevent infection with COVID-19, or are these vaccines designed to reduce the severity of infection and the risk of complications? You know, the vaccine clinical trials were never designed to determine whether vaccinated people who get infected can still be contagious. And so we still have to wait and see about this. But I think it's very likely that the vaccine will prevent infection and therefore will prevent the ability of the person who is vaccinated to transmit the disease to anyone. But let me just take, you know, another comment on that is that I think that it is critically important that all of us continue to maintain certain things. We should continue wearing masks. We should continue social distancing. We should continue hand hygiene, even after being vaccinated, because what we don't want is a lot of people walking around not wearing masks, not doing social distancing because they think, you know, they're safe because they have the vaccine. I think that it is in the public interest for all of us to continue to do these things, which will really keep a lid on this infection until we're able to reach that herd immunity, which means 70% are vaccinated. So long-winded answer to that question, but my recommendation would be that if your spouse is vaccinated, you should follow their lead.
Sounds like a good plan always. Adam says, what are the differences between the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines? Are they all pretty much the same?
Yeah, both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. So they are both, and these are unique vaccines. They've never been used before. I think they're brilliant in the way that they were developed. There's every reason to believe they're extraordinarily effective and very, very, very safe. The difference between the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine has to do with the way that the messenger RNA is encapsulated. What Moderna did is they put this lipid molecule sort of on top of the vaccine, which makes it less likely to decompose if it's not in very, very cold temperatures. The problem with the Pfizer vaccine is that it requires storage at minus 70 degrees Celsius, which means that it requires special refrigeration units. The Moderna vaccine does not require that. You can store the vaccine in regular refrigerators, so and that's a big difference. In terms of the immune response, it's probably going to be, I would say it's probably going to be the same. Both have been reported to be 95% effective, so I think it makes no difference whether you get the Moderna or the Pfizer. Moderna hasn't been authorized yet, just the Pfizer has received authorization from the EUA, but I have reason to believe Moderna will also receive emergency use authorization. What you shouldn't do, however, is you should get the second dose. Remember that you did both the Moderna and the Pfizer require two doses. For the Pfizer, it's 3 weeks after the first one. For Moderna, I think it's 4 weeks after the first one. You can't mix and match. That you can't do. If you got the Pfizer vaccine for the first vaccine, you have to get the Pfizer vaccine for the second vaccine.
Should there be any shopping involved in the sense of, do we ask the questions as a good patient? Should we ask the question of our doctor of which vaccine we're getting and why?
You should always ask questions, absolutely. The answer will probably be because this is the one that's made available to us. And whether
this is the one we have.
This is the one we have, you know, and I think that I would not, you know, if the Moderna is authorized and that's the one that your doctor has and then that's the one that you can get, I would absolutely get. I would get the first one that becomes available. I wouldn't have any preference between Moderna and Pfizer from the information that we know about this.
Quick break. We'll be back with more questions and bring in our panel as well. We'll do all of that after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post are all here. You haven't heard them talk yet, but don't worry, they will. And Dr. Jim Fagan joins us this morning. In fact, panel, anybody have a question for Dr. Fagan? All right, hearing none. I'm going to go to the listeners. Chris says, are there heavy metals in the vaccine, such as mercury?
No, there's no mercury in the Pfizer vaccine. There are some aluminum salts, I think, in the vaccine, which act as sort of stabilizers, but there's no mercury in the vaccine at all. So,
and I just want to add, as a PhD in political science, stay away from tuna. because it has mercury.
Mercury, yeah, it does.
Jeff says the doctor spoke to allergies, but what about autoimmune diseases, celiac and or RA?
Yeah, there's no contraindication if you have an autoimmune disease. As far as we know right now, there's not been any problems with, and there are a number of individuals in the clinical trials who had, autoimmune conditions. So I don't think there's any issue with that at all.
Reality check from Jeffrey, who says, what are the issues if there are logistical problems with delivery of the vaccine and the second shot is administered later than 21 days?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's probably more imperative that you don't get the second vaccine less than 21 days. Now, having said that, I'm not suggesting that you put it off for a few months. I would, if you were off a week or so and it was 28 days instead of 21 days, I don't think it would be the end of the world. But, I think that there's going to be major efforts to make sure that individuals get their second dose in a timely fashion. And everyone who receives the vaccination will get a vaccination card, and with the date that they have to come back for the second vaccine, the information regarding the first vaccine will be on there. Obviously it is going to be incumbent upon every individual to make sure that they get themselves revaccinated. If you don't get the second vaccine, the efficacy of that Pfizer vaccine drops from 95% to 53%. So it's certainly in your interest to get the second vaccine. Again, if you were late by a week or so, it certainly probably would not have a major impact.
Please ask the doctor, asks George, to explain why someone who has had COVID-19 should get vaccinated anyway.
Yeah. So it is possible. And again, something we have to learn. It is possible that the immune response to the vaccine may actually be better than the immune response to the infection. We know that the vaccine focuses on the target is that spike protein. The spike is that little thing in the virus, on the surface of the virus, that enables the virus to gain access into a human cell. And the vaccine causes the human body to produce antibodies, which blocks the ability of that virus to penetrate a human cell because they're antibodies directed against the spike protein. The natural immune response to the infection includes antibodies against a whole bunch of other of other proteins that the virus produces. I'm not suggesting that the natural immune response is ineffective. I think it's probably very effective. But there is a possibility that the immune response to the vaccine may produce a better immunity with respect to the fact that that virus can't even gain access into the cell. The other issue is, and how do we know that someone who has been infected is fully is immune? The only way to know is that they don't get a secondary infection. There have been a number of reports of people getting second infections, and those reports are extremely rare. So I think it's very unusual for people to get infected again. I think that the immunity to the natural infection is probably very, very good. But again, the rationale behind getting vaccinated, even if you have had the infection, is that it will probably boost your immune response, and so the indication is to receive the vaccine. There's no downside to that at all. There's no downside to getting the vaccine if you've been infected. You're not going to have a reaction to that. But there is an upside in that it's another layer of protection, and I think that that's important.
Bill asks a question which seems to me to be a very good one. I'll let you decide, doctor. But I'm confused, says Bill, if the vaccine makes you immune from receiving the virus or just from getting the disease. Can you talk about the difference between having the coronavirus, transmitting the coronavirus, and having the COVID-19 disease?
Well, it's the same thing. Having the COVID-19 disease means you're infected. Now, unless you're asking, did you previously have it? So if you have COVID-19, that means that you are or were actively infected by the virus. That's what that means. You have the disease. Now, you can be asymptomatic, and a lot of younger individuals are asymptomatic, and they may not have any symptoms at all and still have the disease and still be capable of transmitting the infection. So that's always a possibility. But if you have COVID-19, if someone says, I had COVID-19, that is basically they're saying that they were infected with COVID-19.
What are the protocols with respect to mask wearing for those persons receiving the vaccine, asks Christine.
Well, I think that, as I mentioned before, I think that it is our responsibility to the people around us, the community at large, to continue wearing masks, even if you have been vaccinated. And I think that until we get herd immunity, I think that it would be certainly indicated for everyone to continue to wear a mask, to social distance, and engage in and hand hygiene. I don't think we should let up on that. I think it would be a big mistake for everyone who got vaccinated to all of a sudden shed their mask and don't wear, walk out in the street. I mean, we're going to see a lot of people who are not wearing masks. And I think, there's still going to be a ton of people who have not been vaccinated. So I think my concern is that people may start getting the wrong message. So I think that it would be incumbent upon all of us to continue to wear a mask even after we have received the vaccine and until such time that we see the numbers dramatically decrease, and so we have established that we have reached herd immunity. Once that happens, then absolutely we can begin relaxing some of those concerns.
Running out of time with Dr. Fagan, so just a couple more questions here. John says, Doctor, is any of the vaccine or any of the vaccines arriving either counterindicated for heart disease patients or better for them?
No, neither that I'm aware of. There's no contraindication in either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine with regard to cardiovascular disease. So I think that either one would be fine.
We go to Jeff. I plan on taking the jab as soon as it's available to me. That being said, there's no possible way to say that this vaccine is absolutely safe. It's a new type of vaccine with no track record. We won't know for months or maybe years if there are going to be any serious problems with the vaccine. To question why some people would be skeptical about this new vaccine is just not approaching the issue in a fair and balanced manner. It would be informative to have some on the panel who could speak to the fair questions that come from the other side. As I said, I'll take the jab, but we'll do it with the full knowledge that I may not know for a long time if there will be serious side effects.
Yeah.
Let me just ask, because you brought up baby aspirin. And baby aspirin's been around for decades, so we have a pretty good idea of what baby aspirin does. And yet, so the first person in New York got a shot 20 minutes ago. We're going to learn more as time goes on, right?
Absolutely. And that's a valid question. I'm not, it's a new vaccine, and it is a valid concern. Is there a possibility that there may be side effects to this that we are completely unaware of and that we will only learn about months or perhaps years down the road? Absolutely, yes, there is. Yeah, there is a risk to a new medication and a new vaccine. We've had, phase 3 clinical trials, but there's phase 4 clinical trial, which means you continue to follow this and see what happens a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road. Absolutely a legitimate concern. But I think you have to weigh that concern with what is the concern in terms of what's going on with this pandemic. I mean, the risk of dying from COVID-19 certainly far outweighs the risk of dying or having a severe reaction from the vaccine. I'm not downplaying the possibility that there may be a reaction to this vaccine. I think that, we all have those concerns. I think those concerns are valid. But I think that you have to, like everything else, weigh the risks versus the benefits. And right now, based on what we know about this vaccine, the benefits far, far, far outweigh the risks.
All right, Dr. Jim Fagan, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. It's always a pleasure to have you on our program. We know it is you're giving up a great deal of time, and we very much appreciate it to explain things to our listeners. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Jim.
Be well. Thank you. All right, when we return, we'll hear from the rest of the group. Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, Alan Chartok. We have a lot to talk about. We'll do that right after the news break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let's go to other topics talk about what is happening this morning. And again, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we will get to those in just a few minutes. So, Malcolm, let's begin with you here and talk about Russian hackers breaking into federal agencies, a suspicion that U.S. officials have email systems were breached at the Treasury and Commerce Departments in one of the most sophisticated and perhaps largest hacks in more than 5 years. What is going on and how concerned should we be?
Well, we shouldn't be too particularly concerned because it appears that U.S. intelligence was waiting for these hackings. And what they really weren't hackings. What was happening is exactly what happened to the Democratic National Committee in 2016. And they the Russians tend to use a technique called spear phishing. And what that is that they will send emails out to their target agencies, to virtually every email that they can get access to. And they have links in them that are filled with malware. If you click on those links, which can be made to look like coming from your boss, coming from your coworker, you click on those links, it will surreptitiously insert a virus into your system. And from there, they can try to get administrator controls to actually open up your system. And that's what happened with the DNC back in 2015. And that's how they hacked the DNC and got all the emails. And that's how they got to, Leon Podesta's emails. Inadvertent clicking on these links or clicking on these animations. The Russians have done this before. They did it against the Pentagon. They did it against the White House in an operation called Code Monkeys, where they sent a little animation that looked like monkeys, and White House staff back in, it's 2010, were clicking on these, and that, of course, linked them to computers in Moscow. Don't click on any links is the moral of this story. But the Russians that are doing this to try to gain access to the Treasury is concerning. And also they did it to try to gain access to organizations and institutions that are handling the COVID vaccine.
Alan.
So what's to say except that where is Donald Trump now? You know, the media is telling us it's the Russians. Malcolm is telling us it's probably the Russians. And yet the president of the United States, as Nancy Pelosi put it, all roads lead to Putin, hasn't said beans about the whole thing. It's scary. Malcolm says we shouldn't be too concerned, and Dr. Fagan says this or that, and I believe him, and I believe Malcolm.
All right.
You know, quick little aside here. The malware suite that was inserted in there is very well known. It's called ATP-29, also known as Cozy Bear. It's not an actual organization. It's a way that they do operations. And that is associated almost exclusively to the Russians' clandestine intelligence service. So we know it's them. I mean, they've done this hundreds and hundreds of times all around the world.
I think he lives up here. He's been spotted many times, Cozy Bear.
Jennifer, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I have a question, I think, for Malcolm. Well, for anybody on the panel, but Malcolm specifically. And that is, as I was reading this, I was looking at when they were trying to get information from, which I gather is recent information, but also going back for as many years as they can. And I was wondering if there's any suggestion that this might be connected to Hunter Biden. Because we look at or we consider how Trump and Putin have some sort of relationship happening here. And when we think about the leaking of emails and using content of emails, and right now the attacks on Hunter Biden, could it be that there's something there that Russia's digging for or could be looking to share with Trump cronies?
To tell you the truth, as I understand it, this activity started months ago. And you have to understand, the Russians have been extremely successful in using this technique because Americans are just ridiculously, they just click on things all the time. I think that they probably saw this as a guarantee, some sort of insurance policy against the failure of Donald Trump, against Donald Trump losing the election. And so getting really detailed information about the internal workings of the U.S. Treasury gives them financial advantage on the global markets. Look, the Russians use these, they use their intelligence agencies to steal information, to infect things, and use disinformation like the way we buy lattes, right? But I don't think it's done in support of Donald Trump, this particular one. I do think it's interesting that that we really detected it just 2 weeks after Donald Trump fires the head of the agency that would have spearheaded defending the country. So the Russians themselves may have tried an extra special push right after Trump decapitated the agency. But the day-to-day people are doing their jobs, and this was detected. And, we'll see how it goes on in the future.
Libby?
Well, the connection with Biden, I get what Malcolm is saying, but I also get what Ben is saying. I mean, it's all too incestuous in a sense. They're going after Hunter Biden over allegedly bad dealings with China or whatever, but nobody's looking at Jared Kushner or Ivanka and what they've been doing for the last 4 years, profiting off of the U.S. government. I mean, all we see is story after story about this one getting PPE. I mean, Tom Brady got PPP money, and then he bought a yacht. I mean, it's like all these folks and Jerry Falwell getting his money. I mean, and all the evangelicals. It's like all these folks are using the system to reimburse themselves for whatever taxes they may have paid. That's how it feels to me. And the hacking is going to happen. We have to be more diligent. People have to stop clicking on links. That this is very true. But I think we really need to look at who's profiting from all of this, and not just politically, but monetarily as well.
Well, Libby, you make a great point. Malcolm, in all due respect and deference to you, which I always will do, there is no question in my mind that the Trump Putin connection is pretty solid. So that when you see something like this, it can hardly be discounted. As far as I'm concerned, guilty until proven innocent. The French system, the Gaullist system. There you go.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, you left Malcolm
all right.
Speechless.
All right, go away.
I read 3 books about this. So
yes, you
I'm
have.
I agree with you.
All right. Here we go. I want to also, making news also this morning, we want to talk about the charges, the accusations that are being made against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Lindsay Boylan, who is now running for Manhattan Borough President, said the governor would often discuss her physical appearance when she worked for him, a former aide accusing the governor of sexual harassment. This came in a series of tweets yesterday. I could never anticipate what to expect. Would I be grilled on my work, which was very good, or harassed about my looks? Lindsay Boylan, the former aide, wrote on Twitter, or would it be both in the same conversation? Ms. Boylan declined multiple requests for further comment. She has thus far discussed no specific allegations, nor did she provide any immediate corroboration. There is simply no truth to these claims, the governor's press secretary said on Sunday. On Twitter, Ms. Boylan explained her policy of not taking questions from reporters on the topic. She wrote, "I have no interest in talking to journalists. I am about validating the experience of countless women and making sure abuse stops. My worst fear is that this continues." And as it was said, and there's a hashtag that I don't know, but said yesterday, my second worst fear is having to talk about and relive this, referring to a musician who on Friday sued an ex-boyfriend, actor Shia LaBeouf, alleging he physically and emotionally abused her. Ms. Boylan recently launched a campaign for Manhattan Borough President following a failed bid to unseat Representative Gerald Nadler on Manhattan's Upper West Side. So, a lot there. Libby, let me give this to you first. What do you think?
Oh, God, I knew this was going to happen.
Better you than me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alan. So, speaking as a feminist, I never want to question a woman who says she's been sexually harassed, because it just, you know, feeds into the questioning of the veracity of every woman who says she's been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. And we've had these discussions before, and I do, you know, I want to believe women when they make these statements, because why would they make them unless there's some veracity there, unless there's some truth there? The political consultant part of my brain, however, says whether this is true or not, she had been on the headlines of every single major New York City paper, and she's running for the Manhattan Borough President. And so I took a look at her Twitter feed, and she had a tweet about playing three-dimensional chess. And I think that, you know, I'm like so torn here, because I see this from the political expediency side in terms of getting her name out there for Manhattan Borough President after she lost to Jerry Nadler, which, you know, is a fool's errand to run against Jerry Nadler in a Democratic primary in New York City. I mean, it just is. And then I also don't want to doubt women who come forward with these kinds of statements. And so it's really, I'm feeling very, very conflicted about it this morning, because professionally I know exactly what's going on, but personally I also know that what's going on, you know, because yes, 40 years ago, whenever I came here, I was sexually harassed. And it doesn't feel good. And it's a horrible thing. Nobody does it to me now because they know I'd deck them. But, you know, I mean, it happens all the time to women.
Right.
And it's just, you know, I want to believe her. But I also understand she's in the middle of a campaign.
Jennifer Burns.
Can I just say I second what Libby said?
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I think the other thing here is sex scandal type things or sexual harassment scandals are very big. And this is going to sound sort of bad when I say it, but in our era now, people survive them and still go on to be pretty successful in many different ways. Whereas in the past, they would, you know, kill somebody's career. And I do think that she probably experienced sexual harassment, as most women do, and some men do, too. We can't leave that out. But also, I wouldn't be surprised to hear more about perhaps others who say something similar as Biden is picking or looking at who he's going to appoint for his attorney general. Because as I was reading into this, her response seems to be triggered a little bit by Andrew Cuomo's name being thrown out in consideration for attorney general.
Right.
So it's sticky. And again, I am seconding Libby.
You know, one of the things that I was looking at in the response on Twitter, and I realize this is a dangerous rabbit hole to go down, but of people who were responding to this, of people who, let's say, are somewhat respected in their various fields in New York State, again, we're not dismissing in any way, shape, or form the accusation. However, a lot of people were saying, but the governor is like this and really harasses everyone. And I'm wondering how that plays into this of a guy who can be tough and is of how people then respond to it. Because a lot of people said, again, I'm reading on Twitter, but a lot of people are saying, well, I've worked with the governor for 18 years. I've never seen anything that would give me any indication that this were true, other than the fact that he is fairly, you know, he plays with everybody in that sense of commenting and talking and going, you know, after people. So I don't know what to make to how that adds into the equation. I mean, as Jennifer said, I mean, none of it would be right, but it also is then hard to say, okay, well, is this being done solely to this woman? Is it being done just to women in general? And is that sexual harassment versus harassment? And again, that being an allegation. Does that make sense? Libby?
Yes. I mean, we all know, and I'm not making any excuses for behavior, but we all know that he's demanding. There are words that I can't say on the air. He's demanding. He wants things done the way he wants them. He surrounds himself mostly, as we can see in these press conferences, with well-educated, tough white men. The only one who's not is Melissa DeRosa. And certainly she's found the way to navigate within those waters. But this is politics. I mean, you know, it's not like we're dealing with a Mark Allen Siegel, and Allen will know who I'm talking about, who tried to bed every woman he ever met in the New York State Legislature. I mean, he was horrible and horrendous. This is the first time we've heard sexual harassment about Andrew Cuomo. We've heard other things about how difficult he can be, how demanding he is, what a perfectionist he is. You know, some people consider him to be not very democratic in the way he handles stuff. You know, people attack him for the book that just came out on leadership and COVID and all that sort of stuff. But you don't get to where you are. He didn't get to where he is by playing nice. We all know that. You know, he has taken his lumps as well. And I'm not defending him if this woman's story, if Lizzie Boylan is true, but we haven't heard this from anybody else ever. And he's going into what, his 13th year of being governor, 14th year of being governor. Yeah. And we've never heard this at all, ever.
During the height of the Me Too movement as well.
Right.
If I could comment.
Yeah, Malcolm.
You know, in the military, we got this training very, very early on. You do not compliment a person's physical appearance. You compliment their uniform and dress, right? Which is a completely different thing. But in this last year, certainly since Joe Biden's Tara Reid allegations, there's been sort of a weaponization of sexual assault allegations. And the Republicans, the conservatives, and political operatives now understand its potency just by opening your mouth, even though it really defames women that really have had, horrific sexual assault, sexual harassment. And I don't know anything about this case. I don't know anything about Governor Cuomo other than his coronavirus briefings. But when someone is running for office, and this comes out, and it's now that, you know, been technically used as a cudgel against their opponent, I don't know. Maybe it needs to be looked at in a different light.
You know, Malcolm, what you just said about being trained not to look, to talk about dress and uniform, right? but not quote unquote appearance, what's the difference? I mean, really, what is the difference? If a woman is dressed to the nines and somebody says something sexual to her, what's the difference between that and saying, hey, you look great in your uniform? You know, I didn't think a woman would look that good in a uniform with all those medals.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
fine.
Actually, in the military, you know,
there is no difference.
Malcolm?
There is no difference.
Let me just say,
with all the training that you guys have gotten in the military, the amount of sexual violence that goes on in the military is astounding, and it keeps getting swept under the rug. Just talk to Senator Gillibrand about this. She has tried so many times to bring this out, and there's been news stories, but it always ends up being swept under the rug. So there's cleanup to be done everywhere.
Yeah. You misread my comment about what we say. The purpose of us not commenting about a person's physical appearance in uniform, male and female, the most you can go to is you present an outstanding military appearance today. We do not comment about shape. We do not comment about size. We do not comment to women, and we do not comment to men unless it's in the form of an inspection. So that was my comment there. I did not mean that you use it as a tool of sexual harassment. The military's got a lot of issues. I was a Navy chief. I was the front line of handling those issues. I've had sexual assaults, male and female, by straight and other. So trust me, I believe that we still have a culture that is pervasive, male-dominated, and you know, my philosophy for everything I did in the military was shut up and get to work. Anything outside of that was all, you know, was where we found people were having trouble. My questioning with Governor Cuomo was, I'm certain we're going to find the nature of this out, because now every person who has ever worked with him for the last, however, two decades is going to be queried about this.
Alan.
Well, you know, we here at WAMC were mandated by the state, I believe, right, Joe, to have training in this area. And we all did. And I'll tell you what the training suggested. Keep your mouth shut. Do not, and I think this goes to Libby's point, do not start talking about the way people look, anything. The answer is, if you're thinking about it, the answer is no. Don't do it. Now, there's a certain irony in the fact that we're doing this, and everybody in our place had to take it, including me, had to take it because Andrew Cuomo said we had to take it. I think that's something to be considered here also.
I want to, Libby, we only have about a minute and a half and then we go to a break, but I want to go back to something you were talking about, the political consultant side of you. For a candidate, this is all she's going to be asked about over the next 2 weeks.
Right.
What does that do for a candidate in that position?
Well, it's early, right? Petitioning hasn't even started. So she'll be talked about this for the next 2 weeks. And then she'll be seen as an expert on the issue. And she'll be able to use this, I think, as an issue in the race about having to strengthen sexual harassment laws in the city and make sure that this doesn't happen to anybody.
She also gets her name out there in a way that wouldn't have been otherwise.
That's exactly my point from the beginning. I mean, if you go to the JP's Empire Report this morning, it's the top story is the TU story, and then in red he's got the Daily News, the New York Post, the New York Times. This is on the. If I didn't look at all of them, it's either on the front page or, you know, above the fold, inside in every one of those papers, and it gets her name out there. And you know, before she was known, relatively, one would think, in Jerry Nadler's congressional district because she ran a primary against him. Now, citywide, and she's running for Manhattan Borough President. Every strap hanger, if there are any, you know, reads the tabloids. Everybody who...
Got 10 seconds, Libby, but go ahead.
You know, and then people read the New York Times. So her name is getting out there in a way it wouldn't have before.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and her panel discussion. Lots of letters regarding harassment from our listeners. We go to Janet, who said, hey, I third what Libby said. We then go to Erica, who said, I'll say what you all can't. Some women lie, and they have lied and will continue to lie and use their sexuality for advancement. Then they sometimes will regret it and are able to jump on the Me Too train. P.S. There is no gender in the military. As a drill sergeant for 10 years, never a comment on my looks, only shiny boots or exceptionally pressed uniform. We go to Kathy, who says, in the TU, it is reported that they obtained 2018 personnel records from the executive chamber, which show that Boylan herself was accused of bullying, harassing behavior while she worked for the governor, which ultimately led to her resignation. That is a report. The question is why was that? Why were those records, personnel records, obtained, allowed to be obtained by the paper? Right, Alan. I mean, that's also a concern as to why this is.
Well, yeah. I mean, my concern is that she says, I don't want to talk to the press. You know, wait a minute.
Yeah, I find that bizarre.
Yeah.
I really do.
Go ahead, Libby. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, but, you know, if you're going to put this out on Twitter like that and then you say you don't want to talk to the press, give me a break. It's like, what is that about? Why don't you want to talk to the press about this? You know, and you're running for Manhattan Borough President. What else don't you want to talk to the president?
Emma says, anyone who's experienced sexual harassment, which sadly most women have, will tell you that there is a palpable difference between sexual harassment and not being nice. Please err on the side of believing women.
Well, I think Libby was doing exactly that. She was saying her basic feeling is just what's been stated. Nevertheless, I have a nickname for Andrew Cuomo, by the way, and it's Tough Guy Andrew. That's what I always call him because that's what he is. He's a tough guy. And his sense of humor is his sense of humor. I've certainly heard it myself. Nevertheless, I understand. I don't believe that there's a woman alive who really hasn't experienced sexual harassment in one way or another. There is always a presumption of believability.
Denise writes, assuming that women who make accusations do so truthfully because they made the accusation in the first place is absurd. Women are as likely to have ulterior motives for their accusations as men. It should not be seen as stifling the harm to insist on accusers backing up their accusations with specifics.
Who wrote that, Joe?
Denise.
What's the name on it?
Yeah, Denise.
Very interesting.
Jennifer?
You know, I it is shaky ground. And I how do I say this? I understand Ms. Boland's comment that she doesn't want to relive it if it's been a traumatic experience to her. At the same time, there is that other side of the coin where when you're thinking politically, you say, okay, you know, a lot of people are going to be calling. They're going to want comments about this. And the way to deal with it is to say, I'm not commenting on that, but this is what I think about the Green New Deal. This is what I think about, you know, housing in New York. So it can be used, sadly, as a platform, but it shouldn't also be, you know, diminished if she experienced this, that this is something she experienced, but she does have other ideas. And so, you know, it's that kind of tenuous situation that the rest of us are grappling with. And I don't know how or if there's a way for us to be able to move past this kind of issue, because we have seen that our trainings on sexual harassment across the board don't really help so much.
It's interesting. You bring up a great point because you have, in this case, Libby, I was struck by what you said earlier of okay, well, if you're going to, why aren't you going to talk to the press? Why set that rule? It seems that I understand not wanting to relive it, absolutely. But even if it's on her terms of explaining what happened, that helps strengthen her story, doesn't it?
Yes. I'm sorry, but doing this and saying now I'm not going to talk to the press weakens her position. If she really wants to become a champion around this, you've got to talk to the press. You've got to answer these questions. And the fact that she is
she
not going to answer the questions is skeptical. It makes me more skeptical. Sorry,
yeah.
Jennifer, go ahead.
Jennifer.
But doesn't it seem like she doesn't want to make this the issue she's championing? I mean, in some sense, I still throw it out there, and then now you get to talk about your own thing. It's a bait and switch kind of thing that can be abused, and we've seen it be abused in the past, okay? But, you know, sometimes you want to be known for something other than your victimization.
Right.
And so I do feel like sometimes people do want to say, this did happen. Yes, it did. I don't have to keep saying that it did. I have proof of it. I'm not dealing with that now, but this is what I'm dealing. And I would like to say to other people who've experienced this that I know what that's like.
I'm asking this as a question.
And leave it there.
I'm asking this as a question, not as a statement. But when you say I have proof, does she have to offer the proof or just say that she has proof?
You know, that's where it gets sticky again, because of course, if you're going to make these allegations as she has said them, she hasn't charged him with anything or anything like that. So, you know, do you demand of a victim proof? Well, yes, if they want to proceed with some kind of, you know, charges or something. But in this case, she can, I would think, just say, this is my experience. I know what it's like. And I think for many people who've had experience and have tried to move their career in a different direction to get away from it, that will resonate with some of them to say, yeah, I don't want to just be known for this. But it did happen, and maybe she has it, you know, saved on her computer, and I don't know, if she needs it, she'll use it, which sounds even more sinister. But
it's so politically naive of her. It's so politically naive.
I don't know. Didn't she initiate it in the first place? First of all, remember what happened here. First, she said that she let everybody know that she didn't like Cuomo, that there was a toxic, I believe those were her words.
Toxic work environment.
Toxic work environment. And then, and she talked about everybody was scared, all the rest of it. Then we go to the sexual harassment. And I have no doubt that he probably said something like, you look nice today or something like that. Who knows? But nevertheless, she started it. I mean, she tweeted it. Now, to say, I don't want to talk about it to the press, that gets a little bit hairy to me.
I agree, and I do think that this can backfire on her. But we also live in an age right now where people say whatever they want and then proceed with what they think will make them successful, and then people spend hours talking about one thing, whether there's proof or not. Then when the proof comes, nobody pays attention to it anyway because they're onto something else. But like Libby said, this does keep her name out there.
Mm-hmm.
It does keep people looking at her. It does keep people talking. And if she shifts away from that to say, I'm, you know, here's my campaign, this is what my platform is, it I'm not saying it will be successful, but it is a strategy that is often used today.
Well, a lot more people know her now than knew her a week ago, that's for sure.
Right, right. And the thing is that she's not somebody who's known as an expert in X, Y, and Z policy areas. And so making that pivot, she then has to establish herself as the expert so she can talk about these other issues. And I'm wondering, you know, so has that happened? Will that happen? Is she going to be able to pull it off? I don't know. I really don't know. I think only time will tell.
Okay. Go ahead. Did you want to say more?
But this really just flows into the other story about Joe Biden and using her credential.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not about sexual harassment. This is just about a male
misogyny.
Chauvinist pig
who
can't deal
with. That was terrible.
My favorite line in that whole story was, you know, in all my years, Epstein writes, in all my years, I have never used I've never used doctor in my title, and the Post point out, yes, the reason you've never done that is because you don't have a doctorate.
Right.
Your highest degree is a bachelor's degree.
Right.
Yeah, that's why you haven't used it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just, women, we all work really hard for our academic credentials, whatever they are. She worked really hard to get a doctorate. You know, there are plenty of people, I mean, the governor always calls Alan Dr. Chartok. I mean, you know.
But he's sticking the knife in. You know he's sticking
well,
the knife
I,
in.
Well, I understand that. But still, people use their credential as they see fit. And she does have a doctorate. And she's a teacher, so which is a typical female profession. So, of course, people aren't going to see her as being, well, she's just doing what all women do. She teaches. So she uses Dr. Jill Biden. Why not? She should be able to. And this guy is just a pig. Let's be honest about that. He's also homophobic. So he goes after everybody that he doesn't like.
He's also a jerk.
Yeah, well, there's that. That goes with being a pig.
On Morning Joe this morning, they went through a litany of people the Wall Street Journal referred to as doctor, starting with Dr. Henry Kissinger, even Mika Brzezinski's father. Brzezinski. I was a big name, Brzezinski. And they say, apparently, women don't earn this. And I think this should be a national movement that anyone who has a PhD, any woman that has a PhD, and in Jill Biden's case, two master's degrees, right? We should have a national doctor campaign for that.
Okay.
Well, you know, and the other point that I thought was well taken in some of the opinion pieces that have being that are being written is to say that, look, nobody ever expected that if someone in a group had a medical issue that, oh, my God, get Jill Biden. But when in dealing with, as Libby mentioned, in dealing with her subject matter, that of education, which she has aligned herself with since her time as second lady, and as a teacher, why wouldn't you use that title?
Right.
I don't quite understand that. But final.
Use them if you got them.
Final thing here too, in the time we have left. But it's Electoral College Day.
Yay.
Folks, and we will see what happens today, but the Electoral College is voting today, state by state, hour by hour. I believe New York is at noon today, correct? So I assume after what we have heard from the Supreme Court over the weekend that it's going to be business as usual. But, Alan, what do you think?
Well, right now, CNN is reporting that Trump is winning in the Electoral College 11-3. But I mean, we know where this is going. Obviously, unless something absolutely catastrophic or crazy happens, Biden, this is just a formality. Now, have any of us ever seen this kind of hullabaloo about an Electoral College vote? The answer is no.
No.
But
yeah.
This time, with the behavior of this outgoing president, parenthesis, I hope, of the United States, no, this outgoing president of the United States, everybody is paying very rapt attention to what's going on. And it ain't over yet. Even when the Electoral College votes, there'll be this nonsense in the House of Representatives and the Senate where somebody objects, and there's going to be, there'll be that.
All right.
They can object all they want.
Right,
being sworn in.
Yep.
That's it.
That's true.
All right. We're out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Alan, thank you so much. Thanks to Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, and, of course, Dr. Jim Fagan, who joined us in our first hour. I appreciate you all being here. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.